Welcome to the This Is Money podcast in partnership with NSNI, your weekly roundup of the top personal finance, consumer and business stories that editor Simon Lambert and his team have been covering on their award-winning website. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and alongside Simon and I is personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. And this week, housing took centre stage as the Chancellor presented his first autumn budget. Perhaps Philip Hammond was hoping a stamp duty giveaway for first-time buyers could distract us from an otherwise pretty gloomy report on the state of the British economy. Well, not so. Growth forecasts were slashed as productivity continues to puzzle. There was also little cheer for savers and diesel drivers. We take a look at what the budget means for you. Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, where safer savings set you free.
Well, heavy on rhetoric, light on actual substance, with a mini twist thrown in at the end, another budget is commended to the House. Hashtag budget 2017. Well, that was my tweet straight after the budget. We'll get to the twist in a minute, but in 10,000 characters or whatever it is that Twitter now allows you to do. Simon, first, your immediate thoughts, just really briefly, what's the first thing you thought after that budget?
The first thing I thought after the budget was, gosh, that from spreadsheet Phil was a George Osborne-sized rabbit pulled out of the hat at the end. That was a big move from the Chancellor.
So a big move. Rachel, your thoughts?
He really went for the pizzazz in this one, didn't he? With his stupid jokes. The way he spoke was just a lot more sort of understandable. He put in some real crowd pleasers, very quickly rushed through the economic figures, which showed utter gloom. He really said a lot, made it sound very exciting, and with very little substance underneath.
Showmanship. One commentator called him almost sparkling. So from spreadsheet Phil to sparkling Phil. Like you said, Simon, capable of a bit of a George Osborne-style rabbit out of the hat pulling after all. Now, we did know something would come up, didn't we, to woo young voters. And ideas about stamp duty had been circulating, but did anyone see this particular one coming?
One of the biggest challenges facing young first-time buyers is the cash required up front. We've put £10 billion more money into Help to Buy equity loan to help those saving for a deposit. But I want to do more still. I've received representations for a temporary stamp duty holiday to first-time buyers, but this would only help those who are ready to purchase now and would offer nothing for the many who will need to save for years. So with effect from today, for all first-time buyer purchases up to £300,000, I am abolishing stamp duty altogether.
Despite the deliberate headline grabber, we haven't forgotten about the gloomy economic forecast. We will, I promise, get onto those shortly. But first, the stamp duty giveaway was the one that took up the initial newspaper column inches. Now, the move could save first-time buyers up to £5,000, but it didn't take long for that to be pulled apart, this time from the budget watchdog itself, with warnings that far from helping young people, it may actually push up house prices further. So will it help first-time buyers or just homeowners? Rachel, a little bit more detail, if you would, about what Philip Hammond was proposing. When does it come in? What is it? Who qualifies as a first-time buyer?
It comes in now. A first-time buyer is the most frugal definition of a first-time buyer. So you cannot have bought anything anywhere in the world. If you are buying with someone else and they have bought before, even if you haven't, neither of you, it's not like you get half of it or something like that, you get nothing. It applies to properties under 300,000, but recognising that 300,000 doesn't get you very far in places like London now, it applies to the first 300,000 on any property up to the value of 500,000. And the most that this could save you is about £5,000.
Well, every little helps, but I'm looking at your face now. You're not thinking that's the most convincing vote winner for the young.
Well, it sounds great, and it definitely sounds like the Conservative Party is is trying to do something to help first-time buyers. Certainly, it's nothing to sniff at. I've got a friend who's buying at the moment. $5,000 in your pocket. That's not something to laugh about. That's really very good news.
But the biggest problem is the deposit, right?
But and this is the thing, is a 10% deposit on, you know, $300,000. Not to say that it doesn't help paying a bit less on stamp duty, but you still got to somehow conjure up $30,000. And the initial reaction I saw across all media on TV, when they're going around vox popping people and in the press as well, and they were talking to people, young people who are renting, and said, what do you think? And they were like, they just laughed at it, because honestly, what's that going to do? But I guess how I imagine that Hammond might explain it is that it was introduced as a package of measures to tackle not the housing crisis. He rebranded that too. He called it the housing challenge.
Ooh, okay.
Sounds much better, doesn't it? The housing challenge, like a board game. And within that, yes, he's got this stamp duty cut, but he's also throwing money at the problem as well, changing regulation to free up land, investing in the construction industry so that there's the workforce to be able to build the new homes. So I suppose within that whole package, then this one eye-catching stamp duty announcement sounds slightly more palatable. But as you say, even the government's own statisticians, the Office for Budget Responsibility, says that it will ultimately push up house prices. So who knows? My friend who is about to buy, who is thrilled, her brother bought the day before and is obviously furious, and has another brother who, or perhaps a cousin, who's looking to buy at the moment, and he also is furious because he sees that prices ultimately, by the time he gets around to making offers, will have gone up. So there's the sweet spot in the middle. If you're about to buy, you're really going to be angry if you just have, and if you are going to in the longer term, might not help you very much.
But I imagine there's lots of people listening to that story with no sympathy whatsoever, because those people you mentioned are in a position which they can afford to buy with or without a stamp duty cut. Now, we'll get on to what the OBR have said. And Simon, you disagree with it, but also the government reckons 95% of all first-time buyers who pay stamp duty will save, while 80% will pay no stamp duty at all. But it begs the question, how many first-time buyers actually pay stamp duty? Because, of course, in a lot of areas in the country, it won't really reach the threshold with which they will start paying stamp duty, because house prices are lower.
Yes. So the stamp duty kicks in at £125,000. So if you are a first-time buyer and you are buying across vast swathes of the UK, you will probably be paying maybe about £150,000. And at £150,000, under the old stamp duty rules, before this exemption came in, abolition, in fact, it's not an exemption, you would have only paid £500. So at which point, saving £500 versus the cost of buying a property is £500 in your pocket, not £500 in the government's, which is good news for you, but it's not a huge amount of money. If you go up to £200,000, you'd be saving yourself £1,500 from this. Not to be sniffed at, that's starting to be a more meaningful sum of money. But if you were raising a 10% deposit, that's £20,000, so £1,500 versus £20,000. Once you get up to £250,000, though, you'd have been paying £2,500 in stamp duty. And then if you go up to £300,000, because of the way it works, you'd be paying £5,000. Now, keeping £5,000 in your pocket is not something to be sniffed at. And then as you go above £300,000, you still just save £5,000, but you end up paying some stamp duty. Now, obviously, for a lot of people, this won't save them a huge amount of money. But for people buying in the places where house prices are the highest, and let us remember that that is not a benefit to those people. There's this misconception. People buying in high house price areas are in some way benefiting. They're not. They're suffering more than anyone else. And in fact, it's harder to buy there. If you go around the country and compare prices to wages, it is harder to buy in London and the South East and large swathes of the South. They will save a substantial amount of money. And that can only be a good thing, because it is better that they have the money themselves than that money goes on tax. And even if house prices go up, as the OBR suggested,
yes,
it is better that you keep that money yourself, or have that money invested into this thing that you have bought that is ultimately a very long-term investment than that you simply hand that money over to the government. You win. There's also something that's been misconstrued with this, where it's been said, oh, but it's only expected to increase the number of first-time buyers by X amount, 3,500 extra first-time buyers. But that wasn't what this was about. This wasn't about increasing the number of first-time buyers. Actually, first-time buyer numbers are very healthy at the moment. It's about putting more money in first-time buyers' pockets and allowing them to keep hold of more money. But to go back to why I think the OBR logic is flawed, firstly, because they modelled this on some research that the HMRC did in a previous stamp duty holiday when they looked at transactions, they looked at the holiday, and they decided that effectively the amount of money that people were saving on stamp duty was feeding through into higher house prices. Now, I don't think that you can draw across from a temporary holiday that triggered a rush to buy properties, and you can see that in the transactions data and in the mortgage data, that there was a rush to buy properties, to a permanent exemption. And you have to remember that it's all very well saying, well, this will just put some more money in the first-time buyers' pockets and they can just spend some more money on a property. But they are ultimately the people who decide how much they pay for the property. So the seller can't just add it to the price. Mm. So I think that it will have an upward effect on house prices. I think it probably will stimulate a bit more demand in the market. I think it will put a bit of a spring in first-time buyer steps. But I don't think that you can read across that it's just going to go straight onto house prices as the OBR has. As I've said before, I think stamp duty has now effectively turned into a capital gains tax because it is charged at such high levels, but one that is bizarrely paid by the buyer rather than the seller. So you pay a tax based on the profit that someone else has made. Now, there is an idea to turn this around and make it so that the seller pays stamp duty. I've shied away from this for a long time, but I'm thinking that if we can't cut stamp duty to a flat 1% for everyone, maybe it is time to make the seller pay because they are the person making the profit. Now, the big argument against this is that during the changeover period, you will end up paying stamp duty twice on the same property. So to take me as an example, when we bought our flat, we ended up paying 12 grand's worth of stamp duty. If we sold our flat now and we moved to this new system I'm suggesting where the seller pays, I'd have to pay stamp duty on the flat again. But if we sold our flat, we'd be moving to somewhere. And the place that we would be moving to is most likely going to be more expensive. So even if we pay stamp duty twice on the same property, we will end up paying less stamp duty than we would do overall. So to take the example of if we moved round the corner to a house, which we're not going to do, but if we moved round the corner to a house, we'd end up paying about 35 grand's worth of stamp duty, whereas if we bought our flat right now, we'd end up paying 25. So we pay twice on the same flat, we'd pay a total of 12 when we bought it, 25 when we sold it, 37, versus if we paid once on our flat and the house that we bought, we'd pay 47. So it would actually save us money. I'd rather get rid of it altogether. I'd rather cut it down to 1%. But if we're not going to do that and we're going to keep it, maybe we just need to treat it like what it is, a capital gains tax, and the seller pays, but only if you make a profit on the property.
How popular is that idea?
Well, my column had about 230 comments on it. And I believe there was one person who said that this was a very good idea and about 229 people calling me an idiot.
There you go. All right. Well, Rachel mentioned earlier that big package of measures. This is just one part of them that all relates to housing. $44 billion was promised to get Britain housed. But Russell Quirk, CEO of eMove, isn't confident the government has any sort of handle on, well, you can call it the housing crisis, you can call it the housing challenge, whatever you like.
Successive governments have spent a lot of time grabbing headlines through successive budgets, autumn statements and party conferences. There have been references to building more homes, I mean, for many, many, many years. What I see and hear are lots of announcements and lots of notional checks written out. We don't see action. Now, what I'd like to see from the government is an actual action plan, which includes a reclassification of some parts to Greenbelt, would include the government building its own homes or homes for the country, so not just council houses, but actually retail stock, and also ensuring local authorities and national government have a real handle on what land they themselves own that can also be developed, because there's hundreds of thousands of hectares, frankly, of publicly owned land. So maybe tax relief for developers rather than just the stick of the compulsory purchase that I've mentioned. If a plan were put into place and actually executed upon, I would have more confidence. But whilst we just hear kind of headlines without that plan and therefore without much chance of there being any execution, compounded by the fact that we've had now 7 housing ministers in 8 years, and we haven't had a housing minister attend cabinet since 2010. So frankly, how seriously can the government be taking this housing crisis, and it is a crisis, if the housing minister doesn't even attend cabinet? So do I have confidence? Not really.
So Simon, does the government have any sort of handle on, what are we calling it, a challenge, a crisis, whatever it's called?
Well, there was a lot of money announced for new house building, but quite a lot of that money has actually already previously been announced. And this is something that we see repeatedly in government statements and in budgets. But there is more new money. The question is how are we going to build these homes? Certainly, investors thought that trying to stop house builders banking land and encourage them to build quicker was going to be maybe a bit bad for house builders and a bit better for consumers, because house builders' shares fell, but not a huge amount. I think the problem that we have is we've got a lot of people trying to live in the same areas of the country. We have all the people there who are very reluctant to see large-scale building because they don't trust the local authorities and they don't trust the house builders to build decent homes and provide the infrastructure and the services that they need. But also, house prices are so high because money is cheap. Interest rates are super low and people can borrow large sums of money. But I think that the one thing that this stamp duty cut doesn't do anything to do is to help people moving home. And those are the people who are forgotten about. And those are the people where the numbers have fallen dramatically. It's the people in the middle, the people who need to be moving so that they can sell their house to a first-time buyer or buy a house off a downsizer. And unless we do something much more dramatic with stamp duty, those people are just going to sit still and stay put.
Sort of hydra-headed, isn't it? You think you've got one solution, Rachel, and then a whole load more problems come up as a result. What do you reckon? Government's got a grip on this?
No. If you ask anyone what the problem is with the housing challenge crisis, it's we don't have enough houses. It's always brought back to supply and demand. But if you look at any kind of graph about the number of households and the number of homes that we have, this is not true. I mean, yes, to a certain extent, you can alleviate the problem by building more houses. But I think it's as Simon says, houses are much too expensive. And the only way to deal with that is either we're all wealthier or we accept that we might have to allow houses to cost a little bit less. None of this is at all palatable. I mean, I feel awkward just saying it. You can't really talk about those things. And so we all kind of cling on to this premise that it's supply and demand. And if only we just built a few more, everything would be solved. But it won't be. It's just cheap money swilling around, pushing up the price of assets, including homes. I mean, where are all these people who can't afford to buy homes living at the moment? They're living in homes.
Well, they're moving back with their parents, aren't they?
I don't know that actually the size of households is increasing necessarily because there aren't enough homes. And I'm all into multi-generational living and larger households anyway, I suppose, so long as it's voluntary. So I think they're doing as much as they can without having the unthinkable conversations.
There is this talk of we don't have enough homes, but if you go on to Rightmove, you can find plenty of homes for sale. What we don't have is enough homes for sale that people can afford to buy. That is the crucial difference. And the problem with building more new homes is that new homes are priced as a premium product. New homes tend to be priced slightly above the price of the existing homes. So if the problem we have is that people can't afford the homes that are actually out there for sale right now, on my phone, on Rightmove, I can find you a load of them, then if you build new homes and they're priced at a premium to those homes, they're not going to be able to afford those either. So unless you manage to build new homes that you can sell for less than the cost of the homes that are on the market already, then building new homes is not going to solve the problem.
What is?
Well, people having substantially more money or house prices coming down.
Well, exactly.
One of the two things. Yeah. And we don't seem to be overly happy with the idea of house prices coming down. Mm-hmm. And people's wages,
if you look at the Institute of
People's wages aren't going up.
Report so, after the budget, yeah.
So, yeah, I think we need to be a little bit more radical in the way that we think about things. And the one thing we need to stop doing is just giving people more money, such as the Help to Buy scheme. Mm. Because if you just give people more money, then that does have a tendency to drive up the price of things that they can buy.
OK, well, I did ask whether this would be a vote winner among the young, because, of course, there was a lot of speculation, wasn't there, Rachel, before the budget, that the Conservatives needed to do something to bring the young back to their more, indeed, bring them to the Conservatives full stop. And we had lots of speculation about something related to student loans and et cetera, et cetera. What did we get, though, except for a rail card? And by all means, do talk about the rail card, if you like, for young people. What else was in the budget for them?
No, I think we're going to have to talk a lot more about the rail card.
Right, yeah, OK. Let's do it. Explain what it
really
is.
Really, what else is there? I mean, there is the increase to the minimum wage, which for young people tends to matter a lot. Younger people on lower incomes. But if you think that there's anything really in that budget that's going to help you if you are saddled with $45,000 of debt, if you can't even think about buying a home, if most of your income gets swallowed by your rent, if you're on a 0 hours contract, no, there is nothing there in that budget for you except this rail card.
Oh, Rachel, honestly, talking with Twitter, I think I said something like, this is embarrassing in its tokenism. You can't get it on season tickets, and I'm sure Simon can go into the details about when you can use it, but it's more expensive at peak time, so you don't get the actual third off, do you, during peak time? There's a limit.
Yes, so I have up here the rules for the 16 to 25 rail card. Gets you one third off standard anytime and off peak fares, as well as standard advance and first class fares. So you can use it on a standard anytime and anytime day single and return ticket. However, there is something under here that says minimum fares and time restrictions. A £12 minimum fare applies for journeys starting between 4:30 a.m. and 10 a.m. Monday to Friday, excluding advance fares. So if your ticket was expensive enough, then you'd save a third off it down to that £12. But if your ticket is not that expensive, then you won't save the full third if you are commuting and using it at peak times.
So. And you have to pay £30 for it as well, I should point out. So it's not free. OK, Rachel, the floor is yours. What are your thoughts?
Well, a lot of the problems that are faced by 16 to 25-year-olds are still faced by 25 to 30-year-olds. And so anyone who does travel a bit to alleviate that stinging cost a bit is obviously good news. When you get a third off, it's generally only enough to make that journey seem remotely palatable. I mean, to go to Manchester return and for it to cost you, you know, upwards of £100 just is so painful, makes you want to cry. And you take a third off and it doesn't make it cheap. It just makes it not feel like robbery. So that's good.
Every cloud has a silver lining and all that. And as you did mention, personal allowance as well. Let's move off the rail card. It's too annoying. No, Simon's dragging us back in. Simon, what on earth can we possibly add to this?
The problem with this rail card, well, the yeah. other problem with this rail card is that it doesn't do anything to solve the problem that actually needs to be solved, which is the people paying £4,000 or £5,000 a yeah. year to commute to work. And whether you are 31 or 29, you have this issue, or you might be 41 or 54. You might even be 68 and you've got this issue. What are we going to do about that? I've got a better idea, I've mentioned before. I think we should bring in an official salary sacrifice scheme, just like we do with pension payments and childcare vouchers. One already exists for childcare vouchers. And you can salary sacrifice your rail season ticket. So at least it means that your extortionate rail season ticket to go to work you are paying for out of pre-tax wages. That is a free idea that Philip Hammond is welcome to.
Can I also just point out as well, this isn't that radical because I've got a network rail card, which also gets me a third off. And I'll give you a wee clue. I'm not 30 or under. So actually anybody can use that, although there are lots of restrictions on that as well. And as you mentioned earlier, in some good news, I suppose, for young people and indeed, well, everybody actually, we got news that workers, well, everybody except those in Scotland, will pay slightly less tax next year. The personal allowance has gone up to £11,850, the higher rate tax threshold to £46,350. So that means you get to keep an extra £70 and £240 respectively from your pay packet. Talking before we slightly move on a little, some help to ease delays in universal credit. £1.5 billion here, a lot of controversy over this issue. I'm talking about the help that there is for those who really are struggling.
I mean, there's been all sorts of controversy around it, but the big thing recently has been the 6-week delay in the transition between the old system and the new one that would mean that families might end up waiting 6 weeks until their first payment, which, if you are on a very low income, if you don't have savings to tide you over, is a serious problem. And this announcement goes some way to alleviate that.
Thank you very much. So before we come to what was left out, because savers, unlike the Chancellor, we have not forgotten about you. Other bits and bobs worth a mention. So fuel duty frozen again, but we got a new diesel tax on cars. Those stand down, red top headline writers out there. This is not for white van men and women. But firstly, fuel duty seems rather at odds with lots of plans and rhetoric about electric and driverless cars being pushed forward. We even got a joke, didn't we, about Hammond and May and all that jazz?
Yes, one of the many fine jokes from our Chancellor. Cancel your plans to watch the Morecambe and Wise Christmas special. It's Hammond and May all the way. So the problem with fuel duty for Chancellors now is that some years ago, fuel duty managed to reach such a high level that we maybe just reached the point where it started to become very, very difficult to keep increasing it. So even though the oil price has collapsed in recent years, although regained some ground this year, petrol and diesel is still pretty expensive. And actually, it's considerably more expensive, or feels, as a driver, considerably more expensive now than it felt a short while ago when we were benefiting from the oil price slump. So if you start increasing fuel duty, you start taking more money off people. And once you go outside of London and maybe some of the other major urban centres, people basically have to use their car all the time. And they get angry for the same reason that people get angry about paying £5,000 a year to commute into work. It's because they have to drive to work, and that's where a lot of their petrol money goes on. So, yeah, a freeze on that. But diesel.
Yeah,
the demonisation of diesel continues.
What is VED before? It sounds really dodgy. What is
Yes, it's not a disease that you don't want to get. It is car tax, as we call it in old money. I think that we possibly need someone to sit down with the taxes that we have in this country and a large red pen and put a cross through a lot of them, because car tax is something that has been managed to be made substantially more complicated over recent years. And what you have is you have the car tax that you pay, that's your standard every year car tax, but you also have this showroom tax. And the showroom tax went up a lot recently. The showroom tax is effectively graded on how much carbon dioxide a car pumps out. And it goes up from, for example, £100 for a lower polluting car to £1,200 for a higher polluting car. And what happens is they're going to all be bumped up a band. Any diesel car that doesn't meet certain standards, which is the newest, highest level diesel pollution standards, but also, crucially, this real life emissions driving test rather than the do it in a lab on a rolling road. So that's where a lot of these dodgy results have come from. Any car that hasn't gone through that test and doesn't meet the latest standards is going to get bumped up a band, which is going to cost you more to buy it. So you'll basically have to hand over a couple of £100.
Right.
And the idea is that's nudge theory, for those of you who remember podcast past talking about Richard Thaler, is compared to the cost of buying a new car, an extra couple of £100 on the car tax is not particularly expensive, but it does make people think and it does change their behaviour. So that's what we're trying to do.
Why not white van men and women? Are being super cynical and just thinking this was a good one for the tabloids?
Because they need to buy their vans for work. So they're for work purposes rather than frivolously trundling around poisoning people. But also because it's much harder to buy a van that isn't a diesel van.
Fair enough. All right, so that was an environmental move, and I'm not knocking the idea of diesel is not great for our health. But we also got plans, briefly, Rachel, phasing out plastic takeaway tubs and bottles of water the like. Again, another big winner with the newspapers. I did think a lot of the policies that came out just seemed to sop to some of the campaigns that have been waged quite a lot in the newspapers. Don't get me wrong. A lot of them, like we said, plastics is a great thing. There's too many.
We really have to thank, as a nation, that turtle on Blue Planet who was struggling with the plastic bag. And even Hammond referenced Blue Planet 2, which everyone sits down and gets their weekly dose of wonder followed by a little helping of guilt. And I think that that's perhaps been enough to turn the mood against seeing measures like this as nanny state or, you know, getting in the way, but something quite constructive. And I mean, I think he's just going to look into it. I don't think there's anything particularly concrete just yet. But I personally think that this is the type of stuff that government can do really well. I mean, it's worked with plastic bags, and when things are so systemic to our lifestyles, it's very hard to individually make a difference, make a better choice. But if a government comes along and just regulates to encourage manufacturers to use less of the rubbish stuff, then it's much easier for us to make the right choices. Yeah. So I'm into it.
Things like the plastic bottle deposit scheme and all that that's being trialled around. Maybe we can raise a glass of bubbly or some sort of alcohol, because booze also frozen except for the industrial strength white ciders. What's so for cigarettes? That seems to have gone up quite a lot.
A lot. So
are we now the most expensive in Europe for smoking?
It must be. So I think it was 2 percentage point increase above RPI. Clever how they use RPI when they want to, because that one was more. So RPI is at 4%, that's 6%, plus another percentage point for rollies, that's up to 7%. It kicked in at 6 p.m. on the evening of the budget, so it didn't leave you a lot of time to stock up. And cider up as well. All of the rest has stayed frozen.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, giving you the chance every month to win up to £1 million tax-free.
Now to the areas the Chancellor was particularly quiet on.
The budget was incredibly disappointing when it came to savings and pensions. We've got an ageing population, and we've got 14 million Brits who are unlikely to have enough money to retire on in retirement. So the Chancellor's lack of action on pensions and savings more generally was a disappointment. And ahead of any budget, you always get a lot of speculation about pensions tax relief, which is, you know, the government incentive for people to save into a pension. Now, it's a system that's broken and it's on borrowed time. It's unfair. It costs the government a lot of money, and it really just doesn't act as an incentive to save. I think, you know, you've got the Damocles sword hanging over pensions tax relief. It's something that will need to be looked at by the government sooner rather than later, so we have a system that supports saving and supports auto-enrolment. I think every budget that goes by where they don't put in fundamental reform of pensions tax relief is a missed opportunity. I'm sure that reform of this important area will come at some point in the future, but the sooner we can get that reform, and the sooner we can help more people save more for their retirement.
That was Darren Phipp of the People's Pension. What about savers not mentioned once in the budget? Here's Andrew Hagger, finance expert at MoneyComs, who spoke to Lee Boyce for his article and reckons the Chancellor has hung savers out to dry.
It got to the end of the speech and I thought, oh, I can't believe he's finished, because there's not been one mention of savers. If you look at a budget, there's normally sort of three elements to it. There's the borrowing, the spending, and there's the saving. But the savings bit just seemed to get missed out. I was hoping that there would have been something there to encourage people to save. If you go back 3 years ago, there was the pensioner bond, which was great for people who had a chunk of money and wanted to get a decent return on it. But since then, it's not really done anything for savers. We've almost got into that mentality, if you want something, put it on the plastic and then sort it out later. But the trouble is, the rates that are on offer from the banks in the main are pretty appalling. There's quite a few who haven't passed on the 0.25% base rate rise to their customers. So there's still people out there getting something like 0.1 or 0.2% on their savings, when actually there are deals out there where you can get, you know, 1.3. But it just doesn't seem to be anybody out there at the moment fighting the savers' cause. The consumer credit bubble is growing and growing. People aren't getting pay rises. Inflation is starting to bite. You only need things to start to turn down and people start to lose their jobs or get their overtime cut. And if you haven't got that saving safety net there, that's when we're going to start to see problems. I think, unfortunately, there seemed to be a lot of pressure on him to help first-time buyers, which he obviously addressed. But he should also consider there are young people out there who are saving. You know, they have needs as well. He shouldn't just dismiss them as borrowers or people with no money to save. So, yeah, I think it was an opportunity missed.
So, Rachel, nothing for prudent Brits in there?
Nothing for savers. If you drill down into the numbers in that 86-page document, one of the lovely charts that it gives is forecasts for the savings ratio, the household savings ratio, going, I think, all the way up to 2022. The OBR, the Treasury, expects the ratio to fall no thanks to them, really, because it's just, honestly, the incentive for saving has been so eroded. With inflation at, what, 3% savings rate, really, you can't get much more than about 1.5%. So leave it in a pot somewhere, doing the right prudent thing for a rainy day. Rainy day comes and it's worth less than what you put in.
What would you have liked to have seen? Another, like, pensioner bond or something a bit more substantial?
I don't know that it's the place for gimmicks. I mean, there's two ways of dealing with this. There's the fiscal stuff, moving around taxes that the Chancellor can do. And then there's what the Bank of England can do, the monetary stuff, which is a lot blunter, but a lot more effective at this kind of stuff. And I don't know whether there's a case for saying this is a job for the monetary rather than the fiscal.
Okay, well, we got lots more from the budget. We had £3 billion more put aside for Brexit preparations, £2.8 billion for the NHS, £2.3 billion for research and development, some stuff about maths and cough suites, and we got some fighting talk about a bright future.
I report today on an economy that continues to grow, continues to create more jobs than ever before, and continues to confound those who seek to talk it down. An economy set on a path to a new relationship with our European neighbours and a new future outside the European Union. A future that will be full of change, full of new challenges, and above all, full of new opportunities.
But none of it could sugarcoat the news that the Treasury's official forecasting body dramatically slashed its growth predictions for this year and next. In fact, it delivered its worst forecast for economic expansion in the watchdog's history, largely as a result of a collapse in productivity. Now, the economy is now seen growing by 1.5% this year, 1.4%, compared to a previous prediction of 2% and 1.6%. I think I'm nervous to ask about the productivity explainer, but I'm sure we'll get onto that. But why are, Simon, these figures so significant?
Because if you take the forecasts for how the economy is going to grow over the next 5 years, what that is based on is how much extra stuff we can produce. Because if we only have broadly the same number of people and broadly the same number of companies, then the way to produce extra stuff is to get more productive. Now, we're probably going to see a rise in the number of people and a slight rise in the number of companies, but not enough to really boost growth by a huge amount. So what we need to do is get more productive. And unfortunately, we are not getting more productive. And so that spells bad news for the growth forecasts, which spells bad news for the amount of money that the government will take in tax, but doesn't similar decline on the amount of money that the government will need to spend, which means that our spending more than we take in each year is going to persist for that bit longer. Our deficit will not come down as quickly as we thought, which means that we will not be able to move into surplus and start paying down our debt, which is very, very big and consumes a vast amount of money every year to service the interest payments. And actually is consuming a bit more at the moment because expectations for interest rates and the cost of interest on government debt has moved up. So the interest bill has shifted up as well.
Bringing that down to the pound in our pocket, personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss, what does it mean for us? You know, the interest on the debt and the 1.5% and the 2%. How will that literally play out in the households across Britain?
I don't think it makes a difference at all, because just all it is their forecasts of what they think will happen. It's not what must happen, what will happen.
Which led to my next question of what's the point of economic forecasts? Lots of them are wrong often, aren't they?
They are wrong, and productivity is not funny. But I did have a little laugh at this chart showing the productivity in the UK over the past 15 years. It's there in an 86-page report. Honestly, it's brilliant. The reason that productivity forecasts have been downsized so considerably is because before the crisis, up until 2008, the average productivity growth was 2.1%. So the assumption was that's kind of what we benchmark. that's what it should be. We managed for a decade, we managed 2.1%. And so then every forecast that has been given since then has productivity maybe not quite at 2%, but it's something quite close to it. And the fact is, since then, it's been going up at 0.1%. And so it feels to me like this round of forecasting is the moment at which the OBR, the forecasters, say, do you know what? Maybe that's a bit optimistic, that 2%. Maybe we cannot eke out that level of growth for another decade. And so it feels like a real kind of, I don't know, an admission that things might not be as they were. That we're going to have to reconsider. And this was the budget of getting productivity up, and that's brilliant, and all sorts of things to tackle it. But the notion that until now we've been thinking it should be 2.2%, that's what we had, that's what we should have now, seems a little bit deluded now.
So you're suggesting actually probably not as bad as all that, and actually given the context, this is penultimate budget before Brexit, that indeed... doesn't take a genius to work out there may be trouble ahead. No,
we don't know. That's the thing. We don't know. And they're only doing their best, aren't they? It's their job to forecast.
Bless them. They're trying. They're doing the best.
They've got to come up with some kind of numbers. But in terms of what difference it makes to us, I mean, maybe it will make a bit of a difference to the amount that the Chancellor thinks that he can spend at different points. But the forecasts don't make a difference.
Talking about laughs about productivity, and you know you've been a finance journalist for too long. Simon, I've asked you in podcast past for definitions of productivity. I actually didn't know that I had. It's obviously just gone from my mind, unsurprisingly. But you found one, which hopefully is going to be completely jargon-free. It's going to be so accessible that everyone who hears about the productivity puzzle is going to know exactly what we're talking about. So, Simon, hit me with it. What is the definition you found?
I thought I'd clear this up when digging this morning.
Thank you.
This is from the ONS. Labour productivity is calculated by dividing output by labour input. Output refers to gross value added, which is an estimate of the volume of goods and services produced by an industry and in aggregate for the UK as a whole. Labour inputs in this release are measured in terms of workers, jobs and hours worked. Does that help at all?
That's so much clearer, Simon. I'm so grateful.
Now, not to just be flippant and leave you just puzzled, but to look into the productivity bit here, there is actually an important point in here, which is if you dig into this, okay, output refers to gross value added, which is an estimate of the volume of goods and services produced by an industry and in aggregate for the UK as a whole. How much stuff do we produce? Goods, much easier to measure than services, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Labour inputs, measured in terms of workers, jobs and hours worked. So basically, how many workers are there? How many jobs are there? And how many hours are worked? And if you take those two things, you can work out how productive you are and whether your productivity is rising or not. The big issue is that the OBR has just downgraded and said it was too optimistic in the past. There are some people also saying that maybe the OBR is now being too pessimistic because it's getting much harder to measure that output element because we're seeing this shift towards more digital companies, more digitalization. How do you measure that? It's much easier to measure something that comes out of a factory. So there's a shake-up of the FTSE 100 every so often, periodically. Some companies move up into it, some companies move down from it. In this shake-up that's just coming now, the expectation is that a company called Babcock will fall out of the FTSE 100 because the value of the company as a whole has fallen, and a company that more people will recognise called Just Eat will go up into the FTSE 100. Now, Babcock, it's very easy to measure what Babcock produces. It's an engineering firm. It produces stuff that you can see and you can count and it has orders for and you count them all up. It's much harder to measure what Just Eat produces. I mean, Just Eat delivers takeaways on the most basic level, but Just Eat isn't so valuable because it delivers takeaways. Just Eat is valuable is because of the system that it has built, the software that it has built, the way that it has revolutionized the takeaway delivery industry, and the fact that what is happening off the back of a company like Just Eat is all of these businesses, restaurants for example, that previously would have liked to offer takeaways, but it was a hassle because you had to have a website and you had to have someone on the end of the phone and then you had to have someone to deliver it and all those other things. Just Eat stepped in and made it much, much easier for those businesses to now sell food. And another example of this is Deliveroo, which basically has made it possible for any restaurant anywhere to sell takeaway food. And if you trundle around the place, you see people on Deliveroo bikes flying around all over the place. You sit in a restaurant for long enough, and sometimes you sit in a restaurant and a Deliveroo guy comes in and you're like, I can't believe this restaurant is doing takeaway. Nice restaurants, you know, selling food to people. Now, that means that those restaurants can sell much more food, and it's removed a bit of a headache for them. But are we measuring that well enough? Now, the ONS is doing some work into this at the moment to try and see whether we are capturing this digital innovation. And the problem for the UK, of course, is that we've got two kind of things running parallel here. We've got our old-fashioned economy of making stuff and doing things. And then we've got our newfangled economy, which is very digital, very innovative. We are at the forefront of a lot of these things. And are we capturing enough of this? Is the OBR being too pessimistic? And if you look at that exciting new part of the economy, can you really think that with all that there, that we're not going to become more productive over the next 5 years?
You sound like Philip Hammond there. Chancellor, well, you know, Simon Lambert.
Just because he's the Chancellor doesn't mean that sometimes he isn't right.
Editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. Where do you go from there? You can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes and tell your friends and family.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds. Creating millions of reasons to celebrate every month.